We would like to send out a special thanks to Native for supporting The Trail Went Cold. Native makes safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. For 20% off your first purchase, please visit nativedeodorant.com and enter the promo code COLD during checkout. That's nativedeodorant.com and the promo code is COLD. Thank you and enjoy the show. April 19th, 1988. Suncrest, Washington. 36-year-old Doyle Wheeler, a former police officer from the San Diego Police Department, is attacked inside his home by a group of armed intruders. They force Wheeler to write a suicide note at gunpoint, hogtie him, and fire a shot which grazes the side of his head, but he winds up surviving the attack. Evidence seems to link the intruders to another San Diego police officer named Donovan Jacobs, whom Wheeler had testified against in a previous murder trial. While Wheeler suspects Jacobs of orchestrating the attempt on his life, Jacobs believes the incident never even happened and accuses Wheeler of fabricating the entire story in order to set him up, but the truth about what actually happened remains unknown. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to the latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and we're going to be doing something a little different from the norm on today's episode. Instead of exploring an unsolved murder or a missing persons case, we are going to explore an attempted murder in which the victim survived the attack. Or, depending on whom you asked, an elaborate hoax which was orchestrated by the victim to set up his rival. The story involves a retired San Diego police officer named Doyle Wheeler, who had moved with his family to Washington State before he was attacked in his home by a group of unidentified intruders who seemingly made a failed attempt to murder him. Wheeler immediately suspected that the incident was an elaborate revenge scheme masterminded by another San Diego police officer named Donovan Jacobs. To say the least, the two men did not get along, as Wheeler had previously taken the stand and said some not-so-flattering things about Jacobs during a controversial trial. This case was featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries which aired nearly 30 years ago and was one of the more complex segments they ever produced. It was a very multi-layered story with connections to two of the biggest criminal cases which took place in California during the 1980s, the San Ysidro McDonald's Massacre and the murder trial of Sagan Penn. If you're looking for the Unsolved Mysteries segment on Amazon Prime or YouTube, you will not find it because it actually only aired once, and I'll be discussing the rumored reasons why later on. For his part, Donovan Jacobs has always maintained that he had no involvement in the attack on Doyle Wheeler, and has even gone so far as to accuse Wheeler of staging the incident in order to frame him. So on today's episode, we're going to look at both sides of the story, and also explore the possibility that the truth might actually lie somewhere in the middle. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early accessed episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the bizarre story of Doyle Wheeler. Our story begins in 1988 in Suncrest, Washington, a suburb which is located in Stevens County, nearly 10 miles northwest of Spokane. Our central figure is 36-year-old Doyle Wheeler, who lives in a rural home with his wife Bobby and their two children. Doyle is a former police officer with the San Diego Police Department who has been retired from the force for the past 2.5 years on a stress-related disability, which I'll explore further in a little while. On the afternoon of April the 19th, Doyle was home alone fixing the ice maker on his refrigerator when two men suddenly burst inside the kitchen. At the time, the garage door was unlocked, so the intruders presumably used it to enter the house. Doyle would later describe both men as being in their late 20s and having mustaches, with one of them being blonde and the other sporting dark hair. One of the intruders pulled a .22 caliber handgun on Doyle, while the other wrapped a rope around his neck and they forced him into a nearby office. While he was there, Doyle claimed that he could hear the sound of someone else ransacking the master bedroom upstairs, though he never did get a look at the third intruder. The two assailants told Doyle they were going to make him write a suicide note, but when he refused, they started punching and kicking him. Doyle continued to resist, so they started using cigarettes to burn him on his chest and his back. Things finally reached the point where the intruders told Doyle that if he did not do what they said, they would wait for his children to arrive home and kill them. This threat was enough to convince Doyle to cooperate, so the assailants grabbed a pen and a notepad and told Doyle what to write. It read, quote, "To the San Diego police, I lied at the trial about Donovan Jacobs and the police department. I'm sorry. I make this statement of my own free will. Doyle F. Wheeler," end quote. The two men then took Doyle down into the basement, hogtied him, and leaned him over a couch face down. After the dark-haired man went upstairs, presumably to talk to the third intruder, he returned to the basement and walked into the adjacent laundry room, where he picked up the phone in there to make a call. This prompted the blonde man to switch on a nearby TV set and turn the volume up really loud so Doyle could not hear the phone call. When the dark-haired man returned, he pulled out one of Doyle's old San Diego police badges and pinned it to his chest. He then told Doyle that they were going to make his death look like a drug rip before placing a pillow over the back of Doyle's head and firing a shot down at him. Doyle was pretty certain that this was the end, but at the precise moment the gunshot was fired through the pillow, he managed to jerk his head to the right. As a result, the bullet only wound up grazing the left side of Doyle's head and piercing his ear. Doyle then proceeded to play dead and lay still while the intruders exited the basement. When he heard the sound of a vehicle driving away outside, Doyle finally started moving again and made his way to the laundry room while he was still hogtied. He then knocked the phone off the table by tugging at the cord with his foot and proceeded to use his tongue to dial 911 and call for help. It wasn't long before paramedics and the Stevens County Sheriff's Department arrived at the scene, and Doyle was rushed to the hospital for medical treatment. Ultimately, the gunshot which grazed the side of Doyle's head only caused a minor wound, and he recovered quickly. When police searched the Wheeler home, they discovered that the master bedroom had been ransacked. Since Doyle's collection of badges from his time with the San Diego Police Department was lying out in the open, it was theorized that the intruders had been searching for a badge to pin to his chest. It turned out that a Toyota Tercel station wagon, which belonged to Doyle's wife, was missing after presumably being stolen by the intruders. The following day, the station wagon would be discovered 12 miles away in the parking lot of the 5-mile shopping center in North Spokane. The Stevens County Sheriff's Department would also find the notepad where Doyle had been forced to write his suicide note. When they saw the words San Diego Police and Donovan Jacobs, investigators decided to contact the San Diego PD and would make some surprising discoveries. They learned that Donovan Jacobs was a San Diego police officer who was currently assigned to desk duty after suffering a serious injury in the line of duty. Incredibly, it would turn out that the phone call made from Doyle's laundry room by the dark-haired intruder had been made to the department's narcotics division. Since they automatically recorded all incoming calls, a recording could be heard of the male caller asking for Donovan Jacobs. When a secretary told him, "Just a moment," the caller immediately hung up. Well, it turned out there was no love lost between Doyle Wheeler and Donovan Jacobs. But before I talk about Jacobs, I have to provide some more backstory about Wheeler's 11-year career with the San Diego PD. Prior to joining the department, Wheeler had served in Vietnam in the Army Airborne Rangers and earned 3 Purple Hearts, a Bronze Star, and several other medals. The big turning point of Wheeler's police career occurred on July 18, 1984, when an armed gunman named James Huberty entered a McDonald's restaurant in the San Ysidro neighborhood of San Diego. Over the course of the next 77 minutes, Huberty would proceed to murder 21 people and wound 19 others before a sniper from the SWAT team fired a fatal shot into him. At that time, this was considered to be the deadliest mass shooting in the history of the United States. Anyway, Doyle Wheeler was the first police lieutenant who arrived at the scene and would eventually give an order for the sniper to take Huberty out. But for whatever reason, there would be a 26-minute delay before the SWAT team carried out the order, and it's believed that Huberty killed his last 4 victims during that 26-minute window. While the delay was not Doyle's fault, he felt a personal responsibility over the loss of those 4 lives and became overwhelmed with guilt. The trauma of seeing all the dead victims at the scene of the McDonald's massacre seemed to set something off in him, forcing him to take a leave of absence from the force. Doyle had always struggled with the idea of having killed in combat in Vietnam and in the line of duty as a police officer. He would tell a psychiatrist, quote, "The other police officers treat you like a big hero after you shoot someone, but it bothered me. I didn't become a police officer to kill people. I wanted to save lives," end quote. When Doyle returned from his leave, he soon found out that he was being investigated for a sexual harassment complaint filed by a former female police officer. Doyle always maintained that the officer was lying, as she had been fired for incompetence years earlier. Following the McDonald's massacre, Doyle had never hesitated to express his disagreement with how the situation was handled, and his superiors told him he would be fired if he aired his feelings publicly. He suspected that the sexual harassment complaint was fabricated in order to discredit him, but he still wound up receiving a 5-day suspension for it. On March 1, 1985, while serving his suspension, Doyle reached his breaking point when he learned that a movie was going to be made about the McDonald's massacre. The mental anguish became so overwhelming that he attempted suicide by taking an overdose of Xanax. Thankfully, Doyle wound up surviving, but he knew he could no longer function at his highest capacity as a police officer. After being diagnosed as suffering from major depression and work-related post-traumatic stress disorder, he opted to retire from the force on a stress-related disability. In April of 1986, 6 months following his retirement, Doyle received a subpoena to testify as a defense witness at what had become a heated and controversial murder trial for a young African-American defendant named Sagon Penn. And here's where Donovan Jacobs enters the picture. On March 31, 1985, Jacobs pulled over Sagon Penn's pickup truck in San Diego's Encanto neighborhood. He was backed up by another officer named Thomas Riggs, who pulled up behind him in a separate patrol car. A woman named Sarah Pina Ruiz also happened to be in Riggs' car as part of a civilian ride-along program. Anyway, because this is a very controversial incident which had numerous eyewitnesses, there are different versions of what actually happened here, depending on which source you read. Jacobs would claim that he pulled over Penn for making an illegal U-turn, but since Penn had his brother and other passengers in the truck at that time, it's been alleged that they were being racially profiled as being potential gang members. An altercation ensued, which seemed to escalate when Jacobs asked Penn for his license and became angry when Penn didn't remove the license from his wallet like he was told. This soon led to a violent struggle in which Jacobs beat Penn with his baton until Penn wound up grabbing Jacobs' gun and firing off 6 shots. Penn fired 1 shot into Jacobs' neck before turning and firing 3 shots into Riggs. He also fired 2 more shots through the windshield of Riggs' patrol car, which wounded Sarah Pina Ruiz. Penn then climbed into Jacobs' patrol car and attempted to flee the scene, and he wound up running over Jacobs in the process. About a half hour later, Penn drove to a police station and surrendered himself. While Riggs died from his wounds, Jacobs and Pina Ruiz both survived, though Jacobs suffered serious nerve damage, which left him with permanent paralysis in his left arm. The following year, Penn would go on trial on numerous charges, including first-degree murder in the shooting of Riggs, and attempted murder in the shootings of Jacob and Pena Ruiz. However, Penn's defense team would argue that Jacobs had no cause to pull Penn over in the first place, since the street was too narrow for him to have done an illegal U-turn. They claimed that Jacobs had used racial slurs against Penn before beating him with his baton, so Penn's decision to steal Jacobs' gun and fire off some shots was an act of self-defense, which saved his life. In fact, Penn would claim that he had no intention of firing the gun, and only pointed it at Jacobs to get him to stop, but when Jacobs struck him in the arm with his baton, the gun went off accidentally. Well, like I mentioned earlier, Doyle Wheeler would be called upon to testify for the defense, and further their argument that Jacobs had racially profiled Penn. Indeed, Wheeler had once been Jacobs' supervisor, and testified that Jacobs had a history of troubling incidents with minorities, particularly African-American suspects, and did not hesitate to describe him as being a quote-unquote racist hothead. Wheeler recounted one incident where he reprimanded Jacobs for slamming a handcuffed black suspect's head against a wall at police headquarters without provocation. Wheeler claimed that he had tried to warn his superiors about Jacobs' bigoted behavior, but nothing was ever done to stop him. Wheeler's testimony would compel some other former San Diego police officers to come forward and share their own experiences where they witnessed Jacobs exhibit racist attitudes. One of them even described Jacobs as, quote-unquote, the most prejudiced white person I've ever known and an ideal candidate for the Ku Klux Klan. The jury seemed to believe that this testimony added credence to Penn's claims that the shooting was an act of self-defense against a racist police officer. They ultimately found Penn not guilty of the murder of Riggs, and not guilty of the attempted murder of Jacobs, though they deadlocked 11-1 in favor of acquittal on the attempted murder charge of Pena Ruiz. But the district attorney's office was not going to let this go, so they filed all new charges against Penn, this time charging him with involuntary manslaughter in the death of Riggs, and attempted voluntary manslaughter in the shooting of Jacobs. Penn went on trial for the second time in July of 1987, and once again, Wheeler would be called upon to testify and share his experiences about Jacobs' alleged racist behavior. This time, the jury found Penn not guilty on the manslaughter charges, as well as the original attempted murder charge for the shooting of Pena Ruiz. The district attorney's office elected not to file any more charges against Penn, and he finally walked free. Needless to say, the outcome of these trials did not make Doyle Wheeler the most popular person with the San Diego Police Department. Jacobs always denied Wheeler's accusations that he was a racist, and a number of people were angry that Wheeler had broken the quote-unquote code of silence by testifying about that and playing a role in Penn's acquittal. Following the first trial, Wheeler claimed that he started receiving death threats, so he decided to escape the controversy by moving his family from San Diego to Suncrest, Washington, where they lived a quiet life until Wheeler was attacked inside his home by the group of intruders. Well, since Wheeler had been forced to write a suicide note apologizing for his testimony at the trials, and one of his attackers had made a phone call to the San Diego PD asking for Donovan Jacobs, Wheeler suspected that Jacobs had hired the intruders to kill him as part of an elaborate revenge scheme. In fact, while he could not recall the assailant's name, Wheeler believed that he recognized the dark-haired man who attacked him as an informant with the narcotics division of the San Diego PD, where Jacobs was currently working a desk job. Wheeler even suspected that other members of the San Diego PD might have been involved, and that they came after him in order to send a message to other potential whistleblowers and discourage them from speaking out against police misconduct. Well, when the Stevens County Sheriff's Department contacted Jacobs and the San Diego Police Chief to follow up on this, not only did they deny any involvement in the attack on Wheeler, but they presented a shocking alternate scenario. What if Wheeler fabricated the entire attack himself? Jacobs expressed his belief that Wheeler was attempting to frame him, as well as garner sympathy and attention for himself. Well, the Stevens County Sheriff's Department found no evidence that anyone from the San Diego PD had orchestrated the attack, but they could not find any evidence that Wheeler staged the whole thing either. But there was some evidence to support Wheeler's story. For starters, the medical personnel who first arrived on the scene and untied Wheeler claimed that the ropes were bound so tightly that they did not believe he could have tied himself up. A medical technician who examined the cigarette burns in the center of Wheeler's back also thought it would have been nearly impossible for him to have reached those spots on his own and burn himself. On the day of the attack, one of Wheeler's neighbors claimed that he saw a blue Toyota parked across the street from the Wheeler residence, which seemed out of place. Later that afternoon, the same neighbor recalled hearing a loud bang which sounded like a gunshot while he was working in the yard. Shortly thereafter, he saw Wheeler's Toyota Tercel station wagon speeding away from the scene, and it was only minutes later before the ambulance arrived at the scene following Wheeler's 911 call. Well, earlier that same morning, a security guard at the 5 Mile shopping center recalled seeing four unidentified men talking outside a blue Toyota in the parking lot. And as you might recall, Wheeler's abandoned station wagon would be discovered in that exact same parking lot the following day. Nevertheless, some people still suspected that it was Wheeler who personally made the phone call to the San Diego PD asking for Donovan Jacobs and had attempted to disguise his voice. Since he had been a lieutenant in the communications unit before he retired, Wheeler would have known the direct private number for the narcotics division and been aware that all incoming calls were automatically recorded. Officers from the San Diego PD were asked to listen to a recording of the call, and while the audio quality was not great, they did not believe it sounded like Wheeler's voice, though they could not rule him out with 100% certainty. FBI voice experts were asked to analyze the call and compare it to a recording of Wheeler's voice, but they said it would be difficult to make a positive voice match. The caller only said 9 words during the recording, and the experts said they would need at least 20 words in order to make an accurate comparison. Regardless, they still did a voice comparison test, and seemed to lead towards Wheeler not being the caller. Anyway, the Stevens County Sheriff's Department asked Wheeler to take a lie detector test, but he declined. He said he would be willing to do so if they asked certain individuals from the San Diego PD to take a lie detector test as well, but they never made that request. The California Attorney General's Office and a federal grand jury would conduct their own 3-month investigation into the alleged attack on Wheeler, but failed to come to a conclusion about what happened. Wheeler was shown photographs of several potential suspects, many of whom resembled the composite sketches which were drawn up based on his descriptions, but he was unable to identify any of them as his attackers. The Attorney General's office did ask Donovan Jacobs to take a polygraph, but on the advice of his attorney, he declined to do so. Jacobs would soon retire from the San Diego PD to enter law school, and he eventually opened up his own practice and became an attorney who represented police officers in civil and administrative proceedings and defended them against internal affairs investigations. In October of 1989, the FBI investigated a claim from an informant that he had been offered $1,500 by a police sergeant to attack Doyle Wheeler because he was a quote-unquote bad thorn in the police department's side. The informant said the intention wasn't to commit murder, just harm Wheeler enough to shut him up, but he decided to turn the job down because it was too risky and he was not offered enough money. However, this informant had also served time in prison for perjury, so he was not the most credible witness, and as far as I can tell, his claims were never substantiated. The following month, this case would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and while both Wheeler and Jacobs would be interviewed in the segment, the San Diego Police Department declined to participate in an official capacity. But in the end, it did not lead to any conclusive answers about what happened, so the full truth about the attack on Doyle Wheeler remains unknown. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. But before we continue, we would like to take a moment to thank our new sponsor, Native, as we are very excited that they have decided to support The Trail Went Cold. Our podcast often covers scary stories which can make you sweat, so it's good to have a remedy for that. Native makes safe, simple, effective products that people use in the bathroom every day with trusted ingredients and trusted performance. Because Native is so safe and effective and has fewer, simpler ingredients, you always know everything that's in the deodorant. Native can hang with you in any situation, whether it be your workout, your busy mom life, or a 16-hour day. It comes in a wide variety of enticing scents for both men and women, plus they release new, limited edition seasonal scents throughout the year, which include coconut and vanilla, their most popular scent, lavender and rose, cucumber and mint, and eucalyptus and mint. Native also offers free returns and exchanges in the USA, and if you subscribe to them, you can save 17% and $2 per stick and have them conveniently delivered to your door every 1, 2, 3, or 4 months. My shipment of Native arrived just a few weeks ago, and I ordered the cucumber and mint brand because, well, it makes me feel as cool as a cucumber. I'm happy to say that it smelled great and was very useful protection against what has been a very hot and humid summer. And it's very important to use a deodorant that has clean ingredients, which is what Native always guarantees. So get 20% off your first purchase of Native by visiting nativedeodorant.com and entering the promo code COLD during checkout. That's 20% off your first purchase by going to nativedeodorant.com and entering the promo code COLD. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of the episode. Well, I think it's safe to say that I've never covered a case on The Trail Went Cold quite like this one. The key difference here from most of the other cases I've covered is that the victim survived what happened to him. He was able to express his opinions about who he believed was responsible, while also facing allegations that he made up the entire story and staged an attack on himself. The Unsolved Mysteries segment is quite fascinating to watch, because you have interviews with two former police officers who obviously have an intense dislike for each other and were not hesitant to express it. Now, I mentioned in the intro that the Unsolved Mystery segment only aired on television once, which is why you won't find it on Amazon Prime or YouTube. Well, I can't find an official source that corroborates this, but I have read rumors online that apparently Donovan Jacobs filed a lawsuit against the show because he was not happy with his portrayal in the segment. This would provide a logical explanation for why the segment never re-aired, especially when you consider that Jacobs went on to become an attorney. But like I said, I can't confirm if this is 100% true, and if it is, I have no idea how the lawsuit turned out. I will say that I really don't know how much of a case Jacobs would have had, as the Unsolved Mysteries segment was willing to show both sides of the story and allowed Jacobs to address the accusations against him in his interview. While Wheeler heavily implied that he believed Jacobs was responsible for the attempt on his life, he used very careful wording and never flat out accused Jacobs during his interview, though he was not shy about expressing his belief that Jacobs was a racist. From my research, I don't see any indication that Unsolved Mysteries fudged the facts too much, or used selective editing to make Jacobs look guilty. However, if Jacobs was that unhappy about his portrayal on the show and wanted to file a lawsuit so badly, then he probably should have filed it against himself because, quite frankly, he came across as a major jerk. Regardless of whether you believe Jacobs was responsible for this crime or not, he is clearly a very unlikable person. Perhaps the worst moment in Jacobs' interview is when he compares Wheeler to being a quote-unquote bad kid in school who always wants attention, but then goes so far as to say that Wheeler's previous suicide attempt was done for attention, which is a pretty despicable and insulting remark. Wheeler's suicide attempt had nothing to do with his issues with Jacobs, as it clearly stemmed from his role in the San Ysidro McDonald's massacre, which was the worst mass shooting in U.S. history at that time. Walking into a scene where 21 innocent people were murdered, while feeling you could have done more to save some of these victims, is a pretty traumatic experience. It seems like Wheeler already had PTSD stemming from his combat experiences in Vietnam, and was the type of person who always had a hard time with the idea of taking another human being's life, regardless of whether or not it was justified. If Jacobs legitimately thought that Wheeler staged the home invasion, fine. But the guy was forced to retire because of a stress-related disability, so don't go on national television and accuse him of attempting suicide just because he wanted attention. Now, it is clear that Wheeler was not the most popular person with the San Diego Police Department during his time there. When he retired, some of his fellow officers actually held a party to celebrate, and apparently continued to do so on the anniversary date for the next few years. But I don't know if that says as much about Wheeler, as it indicates that the San Diego PD was a pretty toxic place to work during the 1980s. Wheeler just comes across as one of those by-the-book police officers who always believed in being honest and doing the right thing, and sadly, that trait doesn't always win you a lot of friends in that line of work. As an example, during the early 1980s, Wheeler was involved in a departmental investigation into police officers who were using drugs on duty, and in the end, 13 officers wound up losing their jobs. As a result, Doyle's house and his car were vandalized, his police locker was broken into, and his uniform was spray-painted yellow. I actually read a few articles about the filming of the Unsolved Mysteries episode, where the segment's producer compared Wheeler to Frank Serpico, the famous New York Police Department officer who blew the whistle on police corruption and bribery, which did not earn him many friends either, and even led to him being shot and wounded in the line of duty. But to give you an idea about the character of Donovan Jacobs and the San Diego PD at that time, in June of 1989, they actually held a party in which they sold t-shirts which read, "Doyle Wheeler Hit Team," and showed a picture of an ear. A police spokesman would later describe the party as being, quote-unquote, tacky and poorly conceived, and Wheeler commented on the situation by stating, quote, "Donovan Jacobs, for all intents and purposes, is confessing and thumbing his nose at the system by saying, 'I did it, but you can't prove it,'" end quote. Of course, any objective viewer who watches the Unsolved Mysteries segment would probably conclude that Wheeler comes across a lot better than Jacobs during his interviews, so the natural inclination is to automatically believe Wheeler's theory that Jacobs tried to have him killed as some sort of revenge scheme. But the whole situation is just so utterly bizarre that nothing about it makes complete sense, so I have to look at this case from all the different angles. I'll state right up front that I do not believe Wheeler staged the attack on himself, because when you look at the evidence, that just seems outright impossible. For starters, there's the fact that Doyle was found hogtied, and the medical personnel who arrived at the scene thought the ropes were bound so tightly that there's no way Doyle could have done that to himself. This may bring back memories of my previous podcast episode about the death of Cindy James. As you might recall, her body was found hogtied in a vacant lot after several years of suffering non-stop harassment, but the police believed that Cindy staged the whole thing and committed suicide, and even brought in a knot expert to demonstrate that it would have been possible for her to hogtie herself. But the key difference between these cases is that Cindy died from ingesting morphine, whereas Doyle was found with a gunshot wound which grazed the side of his head and injured his left ear. Theoretically, I guess Doyle could have fired off a gun and caused a self-inflicted wound before tying himself up, but the problem is that there was no gun at the scene, and I see no indication that investigators found any weapons inside the house which had recently been fired. But the biggest argument against Doyle staging the whole thing is that his wife's station wagon was found in a shopping center parking lot 12 miles away. If Doyle drove it there himself, how did he make it back home? Furthermore, his neighbor claimed that he saw the station wagon speeding away only minutes before the ambulance arrived, and there's just no conceivable way he could abandon the vehicle at the shopping center, somehow travel 12 miles back to his home, fire off a shot which grazes the side of his head, get rid of the gun, and then hogtie himself during a very small window of time. We also have the neighbor's sighting of a blue Toyota in the neighborhood, as well as a separate sighting of four men standing outside a blue Toyota in the same shopping center parking lot earlier that morning, so this really does suggest that those guys were the perpetrators. Really, the only way Doyle could have staged the whole thing is if he hired these guys to break into his house, rough him up, and hogtie him. But what purpose would this serve? Did he really have that much of a vendetta against Donovan Jacobs? When confronted with this theory, Doyle's response was, quote, "If it took two dimes to go on around the world, I couldn't get on a bus to get out of town, so I don't know how I'd pay somebody to shoot me," end quote. It's true that Doyle wasn't exactly making a lot of income from his early retirement pension, and I don't believe he was employed at that time. In fact, after he was hospitalized for the attack, Doyle had trouble convincing the San Diego Police Officers Association to cover his $1,500 worth of medical expenses. They believed his injuries were self-inflicted and not covered by their insurance, and Doyle became concerned that the debt might go to a collection agency. Considering that it appears there were at least four people involved in what happened, you really do wonder where Doyle would have gotten the money to pay everyone. But the main reason I do not believe that Doyle hired these guys is because they put a pillow over the back of his head and fired a bullet through it. Would you really trust someone to fire a gunshot that close to your head and be so certain that they wouldn't kill you or cause serious brain damage? If you really wanted to stage a shooting, there are far less dangerous ways to do so. Some people might be suspicious that Doyle refused to take a lie detector test, but as you're well aware, polygraphs are very unreliable, and being a former police officer, Doyle probably would have known that better than anyone. He pretty much held the attitude that if Donovan Jacobs wouldn't agree to take a polygraph, he wouldn't take one either. Overall, I'm pretty certain this incident happened exactly the way Doyle described it, but figuring out who orchestrated the whole thing is a bit more complicated. It's so tempting to go with the simplest explanation and believe that Donovan Jacobs hired these guys, but there is so much about this plan which makes no sense whatsoever. We do know that Doyle saw two of the assailants, one of whom he thought he recognized as an informant for the narcotics division of the San Diego PD, but he also claims he heard at least one other person ransacking the house, though he never actually saw them. And there's also the security guard who claims he saw four men standing outside a blue Toyota in the shopping center parking lot that morning. I always wondered why the intruders would go to the trouble of stealing Doyle's station wagon, but I'm guessing they didn't want to leave the Toyota parked outside the house the entire time they were there, because it might attract too much attention. So this fourth man probably dropped the other three off in the Toyota, and when the intruders were done, they drove the station wagon to the shopping center to meet their other accomplice there. But that's pretty much the only part of their plan which has any sort of logic to it. I am really confused about why they would force Doyle to write a suicide note, but then stage a scene in which they hogtie him and shoot him in the back of the head. Obviously, nobody is going to believe that Doyle committed suicide if he's found in that position and there's no gun at the scene. Even if they didn't stage the scene that way, the suicide note wasn't exactly convincing, since Doyle never wrote anything about his family. All he did was apologize for lying about Donovan Jacobs and wrote that he made this statement of his own free will, which sounds exactly like the type of statement one would make against their will. I can't be 100% certain, but I get the impression that the suicide note itself was not found at the scene, and investigators were only able to make out the contents of the note by looking at the pad it was written out on. When they tied him up, Doyle claimed that the intruders told him they were going to make his death look like a drug rip. So this gives the impression that they changed their mind about making his death look like a suicide while they were there. But it's not like they left any evidence behind to suggest the crime was drug-related, so I don't know why they thought people would believe that. This now brings us to the phone call the dark-haired intruder made to the narcotics division of the San Diego PD, which is the one part of this whole plan I just cannot figure out. If Jacobs was involved, I wondered if perhaps they wanted to phone him because they realized the staged suicide probably wasn't going to work, so they wanted Jacob's advice about the next course of action. But the entire call was recorded, and it literally consists of nothing more than the caller asking for Donovan Jacobs before he abruptly hangs up. So what purpose did this call serve? Honestly, the call could be construed as the most convincing argument that Wheeler staged the whole thing in an attempt to frame Jacobs. As a former police officer, he would have known that all incoming calls to the department were automatically recorded. While voice tests seem to indicate that Wheeler himself was not the caller, if he was trying to orchestrate a frame-up job, he theoretically could have had someone make this phone call from his house and ask for Jacobs by name before hanging up. This would give off the false impression that the guys who tried to murder Wheeler had been hired by Jacobs. And Jacobs does make a valid point during his Unsolved Mysteries interview. If he was behind this, why would he be stupid enough to have these guys call him at work from the crime scene? Well, I mean, criminals do stupid things all the time, but this particular criminal did not actually speak with Jacobs, he just asked for him before hanging up. If this call wasn't a deliberate setup, the only explanation I can think of is that the caller did legitimately want to ask Jacobs some questions, but then suddenly remembered the call was going to be recorded, which is what prompted him to hang up. And while we're on the subject of stupid criminals, it is pretty weird that these guys would fire a point-blank shot right at the back of Wheeler's head without managing to kill him, and then they just leave without bothering to check if he was actually dead. If this was a murder-for-hire plot, it was one of the most poorly executed ones I've ever seen, yet everyone involved has managed to get away with it for over 30 years. I mentioned earlier that an informant came forward in 1989 and claimed that he had been offered $1,500 by a police sergeant to attack Wheeler inside his home, though his instructions were only to scare him, not kill him. The informant said he turned the job down, but given that he had served time in prison for perjury, he was not the most credible witness, and the name of the police sergeant who supposedly hired him was never made public. Well, in 2008, a poster under the username Eyewitness posted on the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum I'm always referencing. It was his only post there, but Eyewitness claimed that he was Doyle Wheeler himself and provided an interesting story. He said that an informant, though I'm not sure if it was the same one I just mentioned, once came forward and revealed that he had received $2,700 and 2 kilos of cocaine to arrange a hit on Doyle Wheeler. An investigation would subsequently show that $2,700 was missing from a narcotics buy fund, which had been the responsibility of Donovan Jacobs' roommate at the time. This led to the roommate getting fired, but no further legal action was taken. Well, it seems clear that Wheeler has never wavered from his theory that Jacobs was behind what happened to him, but there's still a number of unanswered questions for me, such as what would Jacobs' motive have been? Yes, the obvious motive is that he wanted revenge on Wheeler for testifying and calling him a racist at Sagan Penn's trials, but let's look at the circumstances of how this played out. While Wheeler's testimony did damage to Jacobs' reputation, it doesn't sound like it had a negative impact on his police career. Remember, Penn shot Jacobs and ran over him with his patrol car, and the injuries proved so severe that Jacobs suffered permanent paralysis in his left arm. Regardless of what Wheeler said about him, this meant that Jacobs would never be able to work the streets going after suspects anymore, which is why he spent the rest of his police career working a desk job. Yes, I'm sure Jacobs was not too pleased to see Penn get acquitted and walk free, but by this point, Wheeler had already moved to a completely different state and was no longer a part of his life. Even if Jacobs still had bitter feelings about Wheeler, it seems like an incredible risk to hire multiple criminals, who may or may not have been unreliable drug addicts, to travel nearly 1,300 miles to commit murder for him. Don't get me wrong, I'm not discounting the possibility that Jacobs did this, but I also think it's worth entertaining a third theory. What if this whole scheme was orchestrated by an unknown third party who had a vendetta against both Jacobs and Wheeler and wanted to frame Jacobs for Wheeler's murder? That might seem like an unlikely, over-the-top scenario, but we have to go back and look at the Sagan Penn shooting, which was the source of all this friction to begin with. To say this was a controversial, racially charged case would be an understatement. In summary, just imagine how the Rodney King case would have gone if King had decided to fight back against the officers who beat him by shooting some of them. This story could probably be the subject of its own long-form podcast, so I'm not going to delve too deeply into it here, but I can see why people would have mixed feelings about it. Yes, it seems pretty clear that Jacobs did overstep his boundaries when he pulled Penn over, and I have no trouble believing Wheeler's claims that Jacobs had a problem with minorities. But at the same time, some people would argue that Penn went too far when he stole Jacobs' gun, particularly since Thomas Riggs, the officer who lost his life, was not the instigator of the whole thing, and Penn also fired 2 shots at Sarah Pina Ruiz, a civilian who was no threat to him. Opinions are still sharply divided over Penn's actions, but regardless of which way you lean, two juries believed that he was acting in self-defense and voted not guilty. But even though Penn became a free man again, he went on to live a troubled life in which he had numerous run-ins with the law, and he ultimately committed suicide by overdosing on pills in 2002. I know that many people on the San Diego PD held major resentment towards Doyle Wheeler for sharing his thoughts about Jacobs' racist attitudes at the trials, which no doubt helped the defense's case and played a role in Penn's acquittal. While they argued that Wheeler was complicit in helping a murderer go free, the guy was subpoenaed to testify under oath, and he does not seem like the type of guy who would commit perjury, so Wheeler just went up on the stand and told what he believed to be the honest truth about Jacobs. In the end, it was the jury's decision not to convict Penn, and they voted not guilty on two separate occasions. Now here's what I find particularly interesting. Throughout the two trials, it seems like Jacobs' superiors and most of his fellow officers publicly stood by him, and in spite of the fact that this incident led to his death, the family of Thomas Riggs also offered Jacobs their unwavering support. However, after Penn was acquitted following the second trial, Thomas Riggs' younger brother, Michael, surprised everyone by giving a very critical and outspoken interview about Jacobs, in which he referred to him as a bigot and criticized his conduct, believing that Jacobs' aggressive actions paved the way for his brother being shot. Michael stated, quote, "My personal opinion is that Jacobs killed him, not Penn. I would like to see him drummed off the face of the department," end quote. He also claimed that his brother did not speak very highly of Jacobs and was none too thrilled that they would have to work together. Michael said that his dislike for Jacobs began while he was recovering from the shooting in his hospital bed, because apparently, the very first thing he did was deflect blame and criticize Thomas for escalating the encounter with Penn, even though multiple witnesses would testify that it was Jacobs who had displayed the aggressive attitude. Since Michael was the only member of the Riggs family not to pursue a career in law enforcement, that may have influenced his decision to go public with his criticisms about Jacobs. But Michael was not the only person to feel this way. The Superior Court judge from Penn's second trial also publicly criticized Jacobs and the San Diego PD for their conduct in the Penn case and expressed his belief that Jacobs had used excessive force. As a result, the California Attorney General's office decided to open a new investigation into the case. The investigation wound up lasting 8 months, but in the end, the Attorney General's office announced that they would not be filing any charges against Jacobs or anyone else in law enforcement who was involved with the case. The biggest issue is that securing a conviction against Jacobs for assault or perjury would hinge entirely on Sagan Penn's testimony, but he would not have been the most credible eyewitness, and it sounds like even Penn himself did not want Jacobs to stand trial, because he just wanted to move on with his life. But this is the part I find most intriguing. The date the Attorney General's office officially made this announcement was on April the 12th, 1988, only 1 week before the attack on Doyle Wheeler. I really can't overlook the timing of the whole thing. Now put yourself in Donovan Jacobs' shoes. You've just been through two trials in which you were publicly accused of being a racist, followed by an investigation from the Attorney General to determine whether you committed serious misconduct and should be brought up on charges. Now that you're officially in the clear, are you really going to decide that the next logical step is to orchestrate a murder-for-hire plot in which you hire four thugs to kill the guy who testified against you? By this point, everyone seemed content to move on from the Sagan Penn case, but the attack on Wheeler brought it back into the spotlight. If Jacobs did in fact try to have Wheeler killed, then it just seems like an awfully brazen thing for him to do. But on the other hand, if someone else was upset that Jacobs was not going to face any legal consequences for his actions, what if they felt that the best way to get revenge was to frame him for a crime he did not commit? When you look at the timeline, it does seem a bit more plausible that someone might have been compelled to set Jacobs up, but I still have my doubts it was Wheeler. Virtually all the evidence does suggest that Wheeler is telling the truth, and the circumstances of how he was found make it seem very unlikely that he could have orchestrated the whole thing. That's why I'm intrigued by the alternate theory that an unknown third party was the mastermind, and their plan was to murder or attempt to murder Wheeler, and make it look like Jacobs was behind it. Let's face it, the Sagan Penn trial was such a polarizing event that there could have been any number of people out there who had a grudge against both Wheeler and Jacobs. As a hypothetical example, let's look at Thomas Riggs's brother, Michael Riggs. He openly criticized Jacobs for escalating the situation with Penn, which ultimately cost his brother his life, but on the other hand, he also wasn't happy that Penn was acquitted. While I don't believe Michael ever publicly criticized Wheeler, he may have felt that Wheeler's testimony played a crucial role in helping his brother's killer walk free. Now, I'm in no way accusing Michael Riggs of being behind the attack on Wheeler, because there has never been any evidence to suggest he was involved. There is no evidence which points to a specific third party, but I can't discount the possibility that the entire motive for this crime was to frame or discredit Jacobs, and Wheeler was just an unfortunate scapegoat. In a twisted way, this scenario adds some logic to the most illogical aspects of this plan. It would explain why Wheeler was forced to write a suicide note naming Jacobs and had a San Diego police badge pinned to his chest, and why a phone call was made to Jacobs at the narcotics division. This was a calculated attempt to link Jacobs to the scene and make it look like he was responsible. If a third party was behind all this, it's unclear if killing Wheeler was always part of the plan. While it seems hard to imagine that these intruders could screw up a point-blank shot to the back of Wheeler's head, I'm not sure they could fire a shot like that through a pillow and be 100% certain he would survive. But allowing Wheeler to live would be beneficial to their plan, because he'd automatically assume Jacobs was responsible and add fuel to the fire by publicly pointing the finger at him. But I am really curious to know how people would have interpreted this crime if Wheeler had been killed. Would anyone have bought the idea that he committed suicide if his body was found in a hogtie position and there was no gun at the scene? Would there actually have been a more serious investigation into Jacobs if foul play had taken place? Well, since it appears that at least four men were involved in the attack, it seems like whoever orchestrated the whole thing went all out and had a serious vendetta. If Wheeler was correct when he recognized one of his attackers as an informant with the San Diego PD, then this does suggest that someone affiliated with law enforcement was responsible. If a third party was behind this and intending to frame Jacobs, their biggest flaw may have been that they targeted a guy who had become a pariah with the San Diego PD. Since Wheeler survived the attack, his former employer was quick to discredit him and did not seem particularly interested in seriously investigating Jacobs as a suspect. I think I'm really split here between Jacobs and a third party being the mastermind behind the whole thing, but there is one small detail which sticks out at me. During Sagan Penn's trials, Jacobs had to address accusations that he was affiliated with a white supremacy group and had once been seen wearing a t-shirt with a swastika on it while on duty, though Jacobs denied this, and I'm not sure if these allegations were ever substantiated. But what's interesting is that when describing the blonde-haired attacker who entered his home, Wheeler claims that he saw a double lightning bolt tattooed on his left hand, which is considered to be a neo-Nazi symbol. I don't know if I'm reading too much into that, but it's an interesting connection. Regardless of who actually orchestrated this whole thing, it was a very poorly orchestrated plan. Regardless of who was actually responsible for this whole thing, it was a very poorly orchestrated and conceived plan, and really accomplished nothing in the long run. But I can understand why Unsolved Mysteries would have been compelled to feature this story on their show, because it is quite the rabbit hole. It's a shame that the segment is not available for viewing today, because the main story has connections with two important subjects, mass shootings and the police's treatment of minorities, subjects that are even more relevant today than they were in the mid-1980s. Given that Doyle Wheeler survived the attack and was not the most popular figure in law enforcement, I think it's safe to say that solving this case has never been a top priority. It seems like Wheeler and Jacobs have both moved on with their lives, and I have my doubts we'll ever know the truth about what happened. But the situation is so bizarre that I would love to find out the full story someday. All that being said, if you happen to have any information on the attempted murder of Doyle Wheeler, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email at robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Another reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We've produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, we released a new episode about the unsolved murder of David Buller, a Canadian cold case from Toronto, which I covered during my live show at the True Crime Podcast Festival in Chicago last month. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also released another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Kaylin May R., Jocelyn R., Rebecca R., Erica K., and the Mums and Murder Podcast. Thank you all so much for your support. And before we bring this episode to a close, I'd like to play a promo for a podcast called True Crime Fix. Have a listen.
How many of you know the name Linda Goff or Sarah Marsland? I bet you will have heard of their murderers though, Fred West and Harold Shipman. Hi everybody, this is Steve, the host of True Crime Fix, the podcast which gives the story whilst giving the victim the loudest voice of them all. So far we've covered cases such as Colette Aram, Kitty Genovese, Jackie Paul, JC Sawyer and Molly McLaren. I'll be releasing new episodes every other Friday via Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify and all other available stations. So please come over and subscribe and give my podcast a listen. I really hope that you find these episodes informative. If you would like further information, please follow me on Twitter at True Crime Fix Pod or find me on Facebook, True Crime Fix Podcast. And remember, stay safe, look after each other, and live life to the fullest, because you never know who or what might be coming around the next corner. Take care, everyone.
And this coming weekend, on Saturday, August the 24th, I will be doing a live show at the Ottawa Podcast Festival, an all-day event featuring live shows from a whole bunch of different local podcasts, and I will be doing a live episode of The Trail Went Cold in the 9:30 p.m. slot. So to learn more information or purchase tickets to the event, please visit their website at ottawapodcastfestival.com. I also just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit, as well as the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum, which contains a number of interesting threads about today's case. Need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who is responsible for our eerie music score. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or a review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week, and join me next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold.